Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, Georgia, this is Obscure, Season 4, in American Tragedy. I'm your host, your friend, your ear lover, and literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black, coming at you late. It's late on a Monday night. Last episode, I told you how I've been trying to be better about getting these episodes to Robin on time. And by the way, it is not Robin chiding me for my tardiness. It is a self-directed chiding. And so I'm like, I got to do better. And then, it's Monday and it's almost midnight. And I realized I hadn't recorded the episode yet. Well, what am I doing with my goddamn life if not recording episodes of this podcast? Oh, I'll give you a quick update. Last time I told you I was going to Atlanta, GA to go shoot a movie. Did that. I only worked for, a day, and then I'm going to go back next month and work another day. And it was fun. One of the things about acting for me is that I always feel a lot of dread as I approach the start of my work. And it's entirely based on insecurity and feeling like, oh, geez, I'm going to do a bad job. And so I get all worked up about it. But I was very deliberately trying to stay out of that headspace and just sort of be and go with the flow. And that's what I did, and had a couple scenes with a couple of, well, for lack of a better word, movie stars. Not huge stars, but stars nonetheless. And it was fun. I felt like I did my job and I did a nice job with them. I wasn't intimidated or anything like that. And it was nice. So that, just a happy, I want to say it's an ending because I still have another day to shoot, but, a happy midpoint of this experience. So that was good. Then I came back and then, we celebrated St. Patrick's Day here in Savannah. I wrote about it on my Substack, but if you don't know, and I didn't know before I moved here, Savannah, Georgia has just a massive St. Patrick's Day celebration. You wouldn't think so. Because why would you think that? But it's either the second or third largest St. Patrick's Day celebration in the nation, depending on who you believe. And the whole downtown area where I live just swells with tourists, just people incoming from all over the place, and just a great big festive atmosphere that I do, just about everything in my power to avoid. That, that's not my scene, crowds and crowds of people, but it is fun to go out and sort of amble among the hoi polloi for a little bit. We went to a friend was having a house party, so we went to that couple's house and stayed for, I don't know, 40, 45 minutes or so. You know, it was crowded and there were kids and what was I going to do? Socialize? Come on, grow up. And then we walked around and saw a bit of the parade and then we got some food and just a pleasant St. Patrick's Day celebration. Then the next day I was working out, not working out exercise-wise, but working out by the pool of the new club that I joined. So just things are looking up for old Mikey and potentially for Clyde Griffiths too. You know, last time we were with Clyde, he had gone to the factory and he met his cousin for the first time, Gilbert Griffiths. And the two kind of sized each other up and decided maybe they don't like each other. You know, nobody has said that yet. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to get over my skis on this, but it's clear there's going to be some tension between Gilbert and Clyde. To say, you know, there's a lot of parallels. We've talked about it before. I'll talk about it again between this and Wuthering Heights and this sort of the family dynamics. You know, you've got an interloper coming into a rich family. This poor little hayseed from Kansas City, or Chicago, I should say, by way of Kansas City. And here he is coming into this big family and wants to be treated as one of their own, you know, because he is, after all, he's a blood relative. And Gilbert Griffiths, who's the heir, you know, sees this kid coming in who looks a bit like himself and with his hat in hand, literally comes with his hat in hand. He's got a brown felt hat looking for a job. And so they size each other up, and Clyde, to his credit, is not particularly intimidated by his cousin, and in fact, comes out of their meeting thinking a little bit critically of him. He says he felt, meaning Clyde felt, that this young man, meaning Gilbert, an heir and nothing more to this great industry, was taking to himself airs and superiorities which, but not for his father's skill before him, would not have been possible. In other words, he's calling Gilbert a poser, a wannabe, a bag of hot air. And that's where we're going to pick it up right here in book two, chapter 24 of An American Tragedy. Ah. At the same time, so groundless and insignificant were his claims to any consideration here, meaning Clyde has no claims, that's true, basically groundless and insignificant, other than his uncle is the proprietor of the establishment, and he got along well with his uncle. His uncle offered him a job, and so here he is. So it's not quite groundless and not quite insignificant, although we must admit to ourselves that were it not for the blood ties between the two, it is unlikely Clyde would ever have found himself at this collar-making concern. At the same time, so groundless and insignificant were his claims to any consideration here, and so grateful was he for anything that might be done for him, that he felt heavily obligated already, and tried to smile his best and most ingratiating smile. Yet Gilbert Griffiths at once appeared to take this as a bit of presumption, which ought not to be tolerated in a mere cousin, and particularly one who was seeking a favor of him and his father. However, since his father had troubled to interest himself in him, kind of awkward pronouns there, but we understand, and had given him no, oh geez, so we've got three different he and hims here all in the same sentence, and it does get a little confusing. Okay, however, since Gilbert's father had troubled to interest the senior Mr. Griffiths in Clyde and had given him no alternative, meaning Gilbert, Gilbert continued his wry smile and mental examination, the while he said, "We thought you'd be showing up today or tomorrow. Did you have a pleasant trip?" "Oh, yes, very," replied Clyde, a little confused by this inquiry. "So, you think you'd like to learn something about the manufacturer of collars, do you?" Tone and manner were infiltrated by the utmost condescension. I don't know that I was that much. I don't know if I was condescending to the utmost. Let me try that again. "So, you think you'd like to learn something about the manufacturer of collars, do you?" Well, that was a little bit better, but maybe a little bit too much. But then again, it does say utmost condescension. So I may have gone a little bit over the top there, but what are you going to do? Well, I would certainly like to learn something that would give me a chance to work up, have some future in it, replied Clyde genially and with a desire to placate his young cousin as much as possible. Well, my father was telling me of his talk with you in Chicago. From what he told me, I gather that you haven't had much practical experience of any kind. You don't know how to keep books, do you? No, I don't, replied Clyde a little regretfully. And you're not a stenographer or anything like that? No, sir, I'm not. More sharply, as Clyde said this, he felt that he was dreadfully lacking in every training. And now, I mean, is Gilbert a stenographer? Does Gilbert have these skills of keeping books and the like? Well, he might be able to keep books. I don't know. I assume he went to some sort of business training. And now Gilbert Griffiths looked at him as though he were rather a hopeless proposition indeed from the viewpoint of this concern. Well, the best thing to do with you, I think, he went on, as though before this his father had not indicated to him exactly what was to be done in this case, is to start you in the shrinking room. That's where the manufacturing end of this business begins, and you might as well be learning that from the ground up. Afterwards, when we see how you do down there, we can tell a little bit better what to do with you. If you had any office training, it might be possible to use you up here. Clyde's face fell at this, and Gilbert noticed it. It pleased him. But it's just as well to learn the practical side of the business, whatever you do, he added rather coldly. Not that he desired to comfort Clyde any, but merely to be saying it as a fact. And seeing that Clyde said nothing, he continued. The best thing, I presume, before you try to do anything around here is for you to get settled somewhere. You haven't taken a room anywhere yet, have you? No, I just came in on the noon train, replied Clyde. I was a little dirty, and so I just went up to the hotel to brush up a little. I thought I'd look for a place afterwards. Well, that's all right. Only don't look for any place. I'll have our superintendent see that you're directed to a good boarding house. He knows more about the town than you do. His thought here was that, after all, Clyde was a full cousin, and that it wouldn't do to have him live just anywhere. At the same time, he was greatly concerned lest Clyde get the notion that the family was very much concerned as to where he did live, which most certainly it was not, as he saw it. His final feeling was that he could easily place and control Clyde in such a way as to make him not very important to anyone in any way. His father, the family, all the people who worked here. This Gilbert Griffiths is a real stick in the mud, if you ask me, and I know nobody did, and I apologize for editorializing in such strong language, but I'm sorry, he's a stick in the mud. I'm just trying to think for a second here about Gilbert Griffiths, and being as he is the heir to the family manufacturing concern and growing up as he did, a favored child, the only male in the family, and no doubt a young man of some aptitude and business sense. So why does he feel so obligated to be such a dick to Clyde? Like, why isn't he more secure in his own position that he should feel so threatened by Clyde? You know, young people are going to be young people. They're jealous and petty and competitive and all the rest of it, and I understand that, but it strikes the barest of false notes to me that Gilbert would come in so hot here. You know, he sees his cousin and immediately is thinking of ways to kick the chair out from under him and leave him dangling. Well, that just, something about that doesn't seem quite right. Based on what I know about the Griffiths family and his father, like, why is this Gilbert being such a stick in the mud? That's the question. And maybe we will find out. He reached for a button on his desk and pressed it. A trim girl, very severe and reserved in a green gingham dress, appeared. Can somebody be severe in a green gingham dress? I don't know. Ask Mr. Wiggum to come here. That's Gilbert talking. She disappeared, and presently there entered a medium-sized and nervous, yet moderately stout man who looked as though he were under a great strain. Just going to point out that rarely is anyone ever described as medium-sized. And again, this is a pattern with Dreiser about height and the, seems like the importance and fascination he has with height. He was about 40 years of age, repressed and non-committal. What does that mean exactly? He was non-committal. About what? About everything, I suppose. And maybe that's how, as maybe that's why he's nervous. He's always sensing which way the wind is blowing. He's repressed and non-committal and looked curiously and suspiciously about as though wondering what new trouble impended. His head, as Clyde at once noticed, appeared chronically to incline forward, while at the same time he lifted his eyes as though actually he would prefer not to look up. "Wiggum," began young Griffiths authoritatively, "this is Clyde Griffiths, a cousin of ours. You remember I spoke to you about him."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, he's to be put in the shrinking department for the present. You can show him what he's to do. Afterwards, you'd better have Mrs. Braley show him where he can get a room." All this had been talked over and fixed upon the week before by Gilbert and Wiggum, but now he gave it the ring of an original suggestion. "And you'd better give his name into the timekeeper as beginning tomorrow morning, see?"
"Yes, sir," bowed Wiggum deferentially.
"Is that all?"
"Yes, that's all," concluded Gilbert smartly. "You go with Wiggum, Mr. Griffiths. He'll tell you what to do." Wiggum turned. "If you'll just come with me, Mr. Griffiths," he observed deferentially, as Clyde could see, and that for all of his cousin's apparently condescending attitude, and marched out with Clyde at his heels. And young Gilbert as briskly turned to his own desk, but at the same time shaking his head. His feeling at the moment was that mentally Clyde was not above a good bellboy in a city hotel, probably. Else why should he come on here in this way? "I wonder what he thinks he's going to do here," he continued to think. "Where he thinks he's going to get. Exactly. Where is he going to get? That is the central question, not only of this manufacturing concern, but, my good man, of this novel as a whole. Where does Clyde think he's going to get?" Well, we'll take a pause as we consider that question, and we'll pick it up again when we return in a moment here on Obscure.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back in Obscure, contemplating Clyde's future along with Gilbert Griffiths and wondering just what this fellow thinks he's going to get there in the shrinking room at the Griffith's collar manufacturing concern. All right, let's pick it up again, shall we, as we approach the witching hour here on a Monday, about to be Tuesday. And I have a cat. I don't know if you can hear him, but he's sort of chirruping. He's by my side, and I'm here at the library with him, and it looks like he wants to leave, but that would require me standing, and it's going to be a test of wills. The allergies have kicked in. You know, it's spring here in Savannah, and I've been sneezing, and now I'm feeling sort of the cat dander just sort of floating about my nostrils. I don't know if that's really occurring. It might be psychosomatic because the cat is rubbing against me and complaining. All right, sir. Yes, I see you. Do you just want love or do you want to be released from this prison? All right, I've let him go just because, I'll be honest, he did ask fairly politely. All right, so Clyde has followed Mr. Wiggum, and Gilbert is left to think where he thinks he's going to get. And Clyde, as he followed Mr. Wiggum, was thinking what a wonderful place Mr. Gilbert Griffiths enjoyed. No doubt he came and went as he chose, arrived at the office late, departed early, and somewhere in this very interesting city dwelt with his parents and sister. Sisters in a very fine house, of course. And yet here he was, Gilbert's own cousin, and the nephew of his wealthy uncle, being escorted to work in a very minor department of this great concern. Okay, are we getting a little attitude about our station in life, Clyde Griffiths? Where did you think you were going to end up, kid? What did you think was going to happen when you showed up here? You're going to be given a corner office and an expense account? Grow up, Clyde. It's not the way it works. You gotta earn it. Nevertheless, once they were out of the sight and hearing of Mr. Gilbert Griffiths, he was somewhat diverted from this mood by the sights and sounds of the great manufactory itself. For here, on this very same floor, but beyond the immense office room through which he had passed, was another much larger room filled with rows of bins, facing aisles not more than 5 feet wide and containing, as Clyde could see, enormous quantities of collars boxed in small paper boxes according to sizes. These bins were either being refilled by stock boys who brought more boxed collars from the boxing room in large wooden trucks, or were being as rapidly emptied by order clerks who, trundling small box trucks in front of them, were filling orders from duplicate checklists which they carried in their hands. Well, that's a lot to sort of figure out at a glance, Clyde. Very impressive. Again, we're sort of, he didn't figure all that out. He doesn't know what he's seeing. He's seeing hustle and bustle, but Dreiser is kind of filling in the gaps for us because Dreiser wants to show off that he did his research about how collar manufacturing businesses work. He probably toured one and somebody's like, and this is the boxing room and orders come in here in duplicate and we ship them off to the shipping boxes and blah, 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 blah. He's just showing off his research there because there's no way that Clyde knew what he was looking at. Never worked in a collar factory before, Mr. Griffiths, I presume, commented Mr. Wiggum with somewhat more spirit once he was out of the presence of Gilbert Griffiths. Clyde noticed at once. Oh, that's odd. Once he was out of the presence of Gilbert Griffiths, period, Clyde noticed at once the Mr. Griffiths, period. But that's a sentence fragment, and it doesn't appear to make any sense. Clyde noticed at once the Mr. Griffiths. Oh, I see. And to make that make sense, it probably should be in quotation marks. He noticed that Wiggum called him Mr. Griffiths. Okay. Clyde noticed at once the Mr. Griffiths. Got it. Oh, no, he replied quickly. I never worked at anything like this before. Expect to learn all about the manufacturing end of the game in the course of time, though, I suppose. He was walking briskly along one of the long aisles as he spoke, but Clyde noticed that he shot sly glances in every direction. I'd like to, he answered.
Well, there's a little more to it than some people think, although you often hear there isn't very much to learn. He opened another door, crossed a gloomy hall, and entered still another room, which, filled with bins as was the other, was piled high in every bin with bolts of white cloth. You might as well know little about this, as long as you're going to begin in the shrinking room. Sorry, my nose is itchy. Again, it's the allergies, it's the cat dander, it's the pollen, it's the whole thing. And my nose is kind of raw from me constantly rubbing it. Ugh. Ugh. This always happens in the springtime, and then it breaks out, you know, because I'm touching it with my filthy hands, and then I got zit nose. As long as you're going to begin in the shrinking room, this is the stuff from which the collars are cut, the collars and the lining. They are called webs. Each of these bolts is a web. We take these down in the basement and shrink them, because they can't be used this way. If they are, the collars would shrink after they were cut. But you'll see, we tub them and then dry them afterwards. I know, I told you, Dreiser got a tour and he took copious notes. He's so proud of himself that Dreiser is essentially Wiggums. Dreiser is Wiggums, Wiggums is Dreiser. You know, he's getting the tour. And so now he's cast himself as the smarty pants. And I guess that does make a good deal of sense. I mean, if you got a collar that you have to wash, you don't want the collar to shrink, right? Because then it won't fit on the shirt. So what you do is you pre-shrink the collar, and then it's got no more room to shrink. Makes perfect sense. He marched solemnly on, and Clyde sensed once more that this man was not looking upon him as an ordinary employee by any means. His Mr. Griffiths, his supposition to the effect that Clyde was to learn all about the manufacturing end of the business, as well as his condescension in explaining about those webs of cloth, had already convinced Clyde that he was looked upon as one to whom some slight homage at least must be paid. I will admit to you that for a moment I couldn't think of how to pronounce the word homage. And you I'm sure you heard that in my voice. I was thinking, wait, is that homage? It could be. Homage, but really it's homage. In English, I guess. He followed Mr. Wig. Oh, it's Wiggum. It's just a single Wiggum. There are not multiple Wiggums. He followed Mr. Wiggum, curious as to the significance of this, and soon found himself in an enormous basement, which had been reached by descending a flight of steps at the end of a third hall. Here, by the help of four long rows of incandescent lamps, he discerned row after row of porcelain tubs or troughs lengthwise of the room and end to end, which reached from one exterior wall to the other. And in these, under steaming hot water apparently, were any quantity of those same webs he had just seen upstairs soaking. And nearby, north and south of these tubs, and paralleling them for the length of this room, all of 150 feet in length, were enormous drying racks, or moving skeleton platforms, boxed top and bottom and sides with hot steam pipes, between which on rolls, but festooned in such a fashion as to take advantage of these pipes, above, below, and on either side, were more of these webs, but unwound and wet, and draped as described, yet moving along slowly on these rolls from the east end of the room to the west. The movement, as Clyde could see, was accompanied by an enormous rattle and clatter of ratchet arms, which automatically shook and moved these lengths of cloth forward from east to west. And as they moved, they dried, and were then automatically rewound at the west end of these racks into bolt form once more upon a wooden spool, and then lifted off by a youth whose duty it was to take from these moving platforms. One youth, as Clyde saw, took from two of these tracks at the west end, while at the east end another youth of about his own years fed. That is, he took bolts of this now partially shrunk yet still wet cloth, and attaching one end of it to some moving hooks, saw that it slowly and properly unwound
and fed itself over the drying racks for the entire length of these tracks. As fast as it had gone the way of all webs, another was attached. Holy shit, that was a long process of describing how they put cloth in water. Basically, it sounds like they shrink it the way they make pizzas at Pizza Hut. You've got the ingredients, right? You assemble it, then you put it into one of those sort of conveyor belt pizza cookers. You know, they don't have the traditional pizza oven at the Pizza Hut. They have like conveyor belt pizza cookers. The pizza it goes through the conveyor belt. And the reason you do that is because it automates the process. You know, say the Pizza Hut Corporation has dictated that each pizza is to take 6.5 minutes to cook. Well, you put it in one end of the pizza cooker, 6.5 minutes later, comes out the other end ready to go. Whereas if you have a pizza oven, well, you got to keep checking that by eye, you know, and you put the little thing under and you lift up the pizza, you look, oh, is it golden yet? You know, no, all right, I put it down. And anyway, the pizza cooker takes some of the human element out of it. And it's the same thing with drying or shrinking the bolts of fabric there. You know, you just stick them in there and then, you know, moves along the assembly process. And then some kid on the other end takes it out, throws it on the arms, they shake it out and put it on the steam pipes. The whole thing dries and shrinks and, you know, then Bob's your uncle, as they say. So now I'm concerned that we're going to spend the next 100 pages learning how to make collars in a 1920s collar manufactory, which maybe is interesting a little bit, but not if you're in the habit of reading a work of literature out loud and commenting on it as you go, because what's going to happen is I'm going to learn a lot about collar manufacturing, but I'm not going to care. And if I don't care, chances are you're not going to care. Because the fact of the matter is, this is a business of anachronisms. Nobody's making collars for shirts like this anymore. The collars are already attached to the shirts. It's like in Moby Dick when they spend chapter after chapter describing how you go whaling. Not that I've ever read Moby Dick. Of course I haven't, but I know about these chapters. Or a chapter about how you tie a goddamn sailor's knot or something, you know? Dreiser took his tour and now we got to deal with the consequences of that. What a pain in the ass. Between each two rows of tubs in the center of the room were enormous whirling separators or dryers into which these webs of cloth, as they came from the tubs in which they had been shrinking for 24 hours, were piled and as much water as possible centrifugally extracted before they were spread out on the drying racks. Primarily, little more than this mere physical aspect of the room was grasped by Clyde. Its noise... Okay, good. I'm glad he's acknowledging, at least, Dreiser is, that Clyde couldn't possibly understand exactly what he's looking at. Thank you for just acknowledging that we're in the head of the omniscient narrator. He couldn't grasp by Clyde its noise, its heat, its steam, the energy with which a dozen men and boys were busying themselves with various processes. They were, without exception, clothed only in armless undershirts, a pair of old trousers belted in at the waist, and with canvas-topped and rubber-soled sneakers on their bare feet. The water and the general dampness and the heat of the room seemed obviously to necessitate some such dressing as this. "This is the shrinking room," observed Mr. Wiggum as they entered. "It isn't as nice as some of the others, but it's where the manufacturing process begins. Kemmerer," he called. A short, again height, stocky, full-chested man with a pate, full face, and white, strong-looking arms, dressed in a pair of dirty and wrinkled trousers and an armless flannel shirt, now appeared. Like Wiggum in the presence of Gilbert, he appeared to be very much overawed in the presence of Wiggum. "This is Clyde Griffiths, the cousin of Gilbert Griffiths. I spoke to you about him last week. You remember?" "Yes, sir." "He's to begin down here. He'll show up in the morning." "Yes, sir." "Better put his name down on your checklist. He'll begin at the usual hour." "Yes, sir." Mr. Wiggum, as Clyde noticed, held his head higher, spoke more directly and authoritatively than at any time so far. He seemed to be master, not underling now. 7:30 is the time everyone goes to work here in the morning," went on Mr. Wiggum to Clyde informatively, "but they'll all ring in a little earlier, about 7:20 or so as to have time to change their clothes and get to the machines. Now, if you want to," he added, "Mr. Kemmerer can show you what you'll have to do tomorrow before you leave today. might save a little time. Or you can leave it until then if you want to. Don't make any difference to me. Only if you'll come back to the telephone girl at the main entrance about 5:30, I'll have Mrs. Braley there for you. She's to show you about your room, I believe. I won't be there myself, but you just ask the telephone girl for her. She'll know. He turned and added, "Well, I'll leave you now. And I guess I'll leave you now." "Why not? We've been through it. It's past the witching hour. My nose is itchy. I gotta get to bed. By golf." So that's it, you know. Clyde is, he's off and running, or at least off and hobbling, hobbled as he was by his cousin Gilbert Griffiths. I mean, not really. Look, he's starting in the shrinking room. That's where everybody starts. You always start off in the shrinking room. How many times I gotta tell you that? And who knows? Who knows how far he will rise? Who knows, in fact, where he thinks he will get? And if the getting is good, who knows? We don't know. All we do know is that a murder-suicide better be happening at some point, or we'll all be very disappointed having wasted 2 years of our lives reading this doorstop. But I'll leave it there, and we'll pick it up again on another analgesic episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu.
This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and Robin Lynn. Our theme music is by Craig Wedren. If you listen and like the show, please help us out with a rating and a review. We want to be obscure, but not that obscure. It's an easy way to support the show. Thanks.